A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's one of those questions that sounds simple, but has launched about 1,000 conflicting headlines. He's asking about the relationship between money and happiness. Specifically, everyone's heard the cliche that money doesn't buy happiness, but there's also this persistent idea that below some threshold, more money really does make you happier. What does the actual research show? Where's the cutoff, if there even is one, and how solid is the evidence?
This is one of those topics where the popular understanding is about 10 years behind the actual science, which is frustrating because the research has genuinely moved forward in interesting ways.
By the way, before we dive in, DeepSeek V4 Pro is handling our script today, so if anything sounds unusually coherent, that's why.
Alright, so let's start with the study Everyone Thinks They Know. 2010, Daniel Kahneman and Angus Deaton, both Nobel laureates, by the way, published a paper that found emotional well-being, which is your day-to-day mood, stops improving once household income hits about $75,000. That number became famous. It got repeated everywhere. And it's now widely understood to be wrong, or at least incomplete, in ways that matter enormously.
Because that $75,000 figure is still the first thing people cite in every dinner table conversation about this.
First, that $75,000 was never adjusted for inflation. In today's dollars, even by the time that paper came out, the real threshold was higher. But more importantly, a 2021 study by Matthew Killingsworth at Penn, and this is the one that really upended things, found that happiness continues rising with income well past that point. He used experience sampling, which is where an app pings people randomly throughout the day, and asked them how they're feeling right now. Much better data than asking someone to recall how happy they were last week. And he found no plateau at $75,000. The line kept going up.
Kahneman and Deaton just got it wrong?
Not exactly wrong. They were measuring something slightly different, and their data had limitations. Kahneman himself actually collaborated with Killingsworth later, and they published a paper in 2023 that basically reconciled the two findings. And this is where it gets nuanced in a way that the headlines completely miss. They found that for most people, happiness does keep rising with income, but, and this is the crucial but, there's a subset of people for whom it plateaus, specifically the unhappiest people. For the least happy 15 to 20% of the population, more money stops helping around $100,000 a year. For everyone else, it keeps going.
Wait, let me make sure I'm tracking this. The miserable people hit a ceiling where cash stops mattering, but the already happy people just keep getting happier with more money.
Which is the opposite of what you'd intuitively expect, right? You'd think the unhappy people would benefit most from more resources. But it turns out that if you're deeply unhappy, the sources of that unhappiness, clinical depression, grief, chronic pain, whatever, aren't things that money easily fixes beyond a certain point. Whereas if you're already doing well, more money gives you more options, more freedom, more experiences. It amplifies what's already working.
The real story isn't a simple threshold. It's that the relationship between money and happiness depends on who you are and how you're measuring happiness. Messier than the $75,000 soundbite.
It gets even messier when you look at what happiness actually means in these studies. There's a distinction that keeps coming up in the literature but gets flattened in popular coverage. Kahneman originally separated two things. One is emotional well-being, how often you feel joy, stress, sadness, affection in your daily life. The other is life evaluation. When you step back and think about how your life is going overall, are you satisfied? And these two things respond differently to money.
Which one keeps going up?
Life evaluation keeps rising with income pretty much indefinitely. The more you earn, the more you rate your life as going well. That relationship is surprisingly linear. Emotional well-being is the one where the debate about plateaus happens. And even there, the newer evidence suggests it keeps rising for most people, just at a diminishing rate. The first $50,000 does a lot more for your daily mood than the next $50,000.
There's a diminishing returns curve, not a hard cutoff. which honestly makes more intuitive sense than some magic number where money suddenly stops mattering.
And here's a concrete data point from Killingsworth's work that I think really drives this home. He found that the difference in happiness between someone earning $30,000 and someone earning $60,000 was about the same as the difference between someone earning $60,000 and someone earning $120,000. Which means it's not that money stops mattering, it's that you need proportionally more of it to get the same happiness bump. That's a logarithmic relationship, basically. And that has real implications for how we think about income inequality and taxation and all sorts of things.
Let me push on that a bit. If it's logarithmic, if each additional happiness unit requires doubling your income, that suggests there's no amount of money where the curve actually goes flat. It just gets harder and harder to move the needle.
That's the implication, yes. Though I should note, Killingsworth himself is careful about this. He said in interviews that his data doesn't prove the relationship continues forever. He just didn't find a stopping point in the income range he studied, which went up to about $500,000 a year. Beyond that, we just don't have great data because there aren't enough people earning millions who are also willing to fill out experience sampling surveys.
Which itself is a pretty significant limitation. The people at the very top of the income distribution are systematically excluded from this research. If billionaires are ecstatically happy or deeply miserable, we wouldn't know from these data sets.
And there's been some work trying to fill that gap. There was a study a few years back looking at millionaires. I think it came out of Harvard Business School that surveyed people with a net worth over $10 million. And they did find that even among the very wealthy, more money predicted higher life satisfaction. But the effect sizes were small, and the sample was self-selected in ways that make it hard to generalize.
The short version is, more money correlates with more happiness for basically everyone we've studied. The effect gets smaller as you get richer, and there's a minority of deeply unhappy people for whom the effect cuts out entirely around $100,000. Is that a fair summary of where the research stands?
That's a fair summary, but I want to add one more layer because I think it's the most practically important part of this whole discussion. The effect size of money on happiness is actually pretty small compared to other things. And this gets lost when we focus exclusively on the income question. Killingsworth's data shows that income explains maybe 2-5% of the variation in happiness between people. That's real, but it's dwarfed by things like health, relationships, sense of purpose, and basic personality traits.
2-5%. Honestly, lower than I would have guessed, given how much cultural bandwidth this question consumes.
We obsess over the money-happiness link because money is measurable and we can imagine changing it. But the biggest predictors of happiness are things like whether you're in a good marriage, whether you have close friends, whether you like your job, whether you're physically healthy, whether you get enough sleep. These are harder to quantify and harder to study with the kind of clean causal inference that economists love. So the money question gets disproportionate attention.
There's also the causality problem. Does money make people happier, or do happier people make more money? Because I can easily imagine that someone who's cheerful, emotionally stable, and socially skilled is going to earn more over their lifetime than someone who's miserable and difficult to be around.
That's the million-dollar question, literally. And it's really hard to tease apart. There have been a few studies that try to get at causality. One approach is to look at lottery winners. If you win the lottery, your income goes up for reasons unrelated to your personality or skills. And the classic finding there, this goes back to a famous 1978 study by Brickman and colleagues, is that lottery winners aren't significantly happier than controls. They get a spike right after winning, but within a year or so, they return to baseline.
The hedonic treadmill.
But even that finding has been complicated by more recent work. Some larger studies using better data have found that lottery wins do produce lasting increases in life satisfaction, even if the effect on day-to-day mood is temporary. So you might not feel more joy in your daily life 5 years after winning the lottery, but you'll still rate your life as going better. And honestly, that distinction makes sense. If I had $10 million in the bank, I'd probably still have grumpy Tuesday mornings. But I'd also sleep better knowing my retirement is fully funded.
That's the security dimension, right? Money is a buffer against catastrophe rather than money as a source of pleasure. Those feel like very different mechanisms.
The research supports that distinction. There's a body of work showing that financial distress, not low income per se, but the experience of not being able to pay bills, of being one emergency away from disaster, is terrible for mental health. It causes anxiety, depression, relationship strain. So part of why more money increases happiness isn't that you're buying nicer things, it's that you're reducing a source of chronic stress. Once that stress is gone, additional money is nice but not transformative in the same way.
Which brings us back to that plateau for the unhappiest people. If you're miserable for reasons that aren't financial, say you've lost a spouse or you're dealing with chronic pain, then eliminating financial stress doesn't fix the thing that's actually making you unhappy. The money helped with the part of your unhappiness that was money-related, and then you're left with the rest.
And I think this is where the public conversation about this research often goes off the rails. People hear money doesn't buy happiness and interpret it as money doesn't matter. Or they hear happiness keeps rising with income and interpret it as just get rich and you'll be happy. Both miss the nuance. Money matters, but it's not the main event.
Let's talk about cross-country comparisons, because that's another angle that comes up a lot. The Easterlin paradox, the idea that within a country, richer people are happier, but across countries, richer countries aren't necessarily happier, and over time, as countries get richer, they don't get happier. Is that still considered valid?
The Easterlin paradox has been one of the most debated findings in happiness economics for decades. Richard Easterlin published his original paper in 1974, and the basic claim was exactly what you said. Income and happiness correlate within countries, but not across countries or over time. And for a long time, this was the dominant view, but more recent work with better data has largely overturned it.
Overturned it how?
There was a major paper in 2008 by Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfers, both economists at Penn at the time, that re-examined the cross-country data and found a clear log-linear relationship between GDP, per capita, and average happiness across countries. Richer countries are happier, full stop, and the relationship holds across the full range of countries, from the poorest to the richest, no satiation point. And they found the same thing in within-country data over time. As countries get richer, they get happier on average. The effect is just smaller than the cross-sectional relationship, which is what created the illusion of a paradox.
The paradox was basically a data problem?
Partly data, partly measurement. The earlier studies used happiness measures that were too crude to pick up the effect. When you use better surveys with larger samples, the relationship is clear. And there's been subsequent work confirming this. The World Happiness Report, which comes out every year, consistently shows that the happiest countries are the wealthy ones: Finland, Denmark, Switzerland, Norway. And the least happy are the poorest: Afghanistan, South Sudan, Sierra Leone.
Though I'd push back slightly on the idea that it's purely about GDP, the Nordic countries aren't just rich. They also have strong social safety nets, low inequality, high trust. There are countries with similar GDP per capita that score lower on happiness. The US is richer than Finland, but less happy.
And that's the next layer of the analysis. Income explains a lot of the cross-country variation, but not all of it. Social support, freedom to make life choices, generosity, and absence of corruption all show up as significant predictors in the World Happiness Report data. But here's what I find striking. The income effect is so robust that even when you control for all those other factors, it still matters, and the relationship is logarithmic, same as within countries. A 10% increase in GDP per capita predicts about the same happiness boost whether you're talking about Burundi or Belgium.
The logarithmic pattern shows up at every level, within countries, across countries, over time. That's actually kind of elegant. It suggests there's something fundamental about how humans process material well-being.
That's exactly what the psychologists argue. There's a concept called adaptation. We get used to things. A raise feels amazing for a few months, then it becomes the new normal. A bigger house feels great until it's just your house. This isn't a bug in human psychology, it's a feature. We're built to adapt to our circumstances so we can function in them. But it means that chasing happiness through income is a game where the goalposts keep moving.
Though I want to complicate the adaptation story a bit. Because if adaptation were total, we'd see no relationship between income and happiness at all. The fact that the relationship persists, even if it's logarithmic, suggests we don't fully adapt. Some part of having more resources continues to register.
Right, and there's research on what specifically we don't adapt to. Things that provide novelty and variety. Travel, learning, social experiences seem to resist adaptation better than material purchases. A new car becomes just your car. A trip to a new country creates memories that don't fade in the same way. So it's not just about how much money you have, it's about what you do with it. And this connects to a larger literature on experiential versus material spending.
The experiential spending advantage. Is that solid, or is it one of those findings that's been overhyped?
It's fairly solid, but with important caveats. The basic finding, which comes out of work by Tom Jilovich and others at Cornell, is that spending money on experiences, travel, concerts, meals with friends, classes, produces more lasting happiness than spending the same amount on material goods. The mechanisms are pretty intuitive. Experiences are more likely to be social, they become part of your identity in a way that possessions don't, and they're less subject to comparison. You're less likely to think, I should have gone to a better concert than I should have bought a better car.
The comparison point is interesting. Keeping up with the Joneses is a lot easier with visible material goods than with experiences.
And there's some evidence that the experiential advantage is strongest for people who are already financially comfortable. If you're struggling to pay rent, spending money on a concert instead of a better apartment probably doesn't increase your happiness. So again, the baseline matters. The advice to buy experiences, not things, is good advice for people who already have their basic needs met.
Let's circle back to the policy implications, because I think this is where the research gets consequential. If the relationship between income and happiness is logarithmic, that has implications for taxation and redistribution. A dollar taken from a high earner and given to a low earner should, in theory, increase total happiness. Because the low earner gets more happiness per dollar than the high earner loses.
This is exactly the argument that happiness economists like Richard Layard have been making for years. And it provides a utilitarian justification for progressive taxation that doesn't depend on any moral claims about fairness. It's just about maximizing total well-being. But I think there are some problems with this framing that don't get enough attention. For one, it assumes that income transfers are efficient, that a dollar taxed from a high earner translates into a dollar of value received by a low earner. In practice, tax systems have overhead, welfare programs have administrative costs, and some transfers create behavioral distortions that reduce the total pie. So the simple logarithmic math might overstate the case for redistribution.
There's also the question of whether happiness is the right metric for policy in the first place. I'm not sure I want the government optimizing for my self-reported life satisfaction.
That's a philosophical objection that a lot of people share. But I'd note that we're already optimizing for something. GDP growth, employment, inflation. Those are metrics we've chosen. The question is whether happiness might be a better one, or at least a useful complement. And there are countries experimenting with this. Bhutan famously uses gross national happiness. New Zealand has a well-being budget. The UK's Office for National Statistics started measuring national well-being back in 2010, so this isn't just an academic debate, it's starting to influence actual governance.
Though Bhutan's not exactly a model of economic development, I'm not sure Be More Like Bhutan is a scalable policy recommendation.
But the New Zealand case is more interesting. They're a developed country with a real economy, and they've been trying to orient budget decisions around well-being indicators rather than just GDP growth. The results are mixed so far, partly because it's hard to measure well-being in a way that's precise enough to guide specific spending decisions. But the direction of travel is worth watching.
Let me ask you a more personal question, since you spent decades as a pediatrician before this podcasting life. In your experience, did the relationship between money and happiness show up in your patients' families? Did you see differences between the kids from wealthy families and the kids from struggling families?
I should be careful here because my clinical experience isn't data, it's anecdote filtered through memory. But I'll say this. The families that were struggling financially, I'm talking about choosing between rent and medicine, not about whether they could afford a second vacation, those kids had worse outcomes across the board. More stress-related illness, more behavioral problems, more missed appointments. Poverty is toxic to children in ways that are measurable and profound. That's not controversial in pediatrics.
At the other end,
the differences were much less clear. Some wealthy families had kids who were thriving. Others had kids who were anxious, pressured, disconnected. Money solved certain problems and created others. I saw plenty of affluent teenagers who were miserable. Not because anything was wrong with their lives in an objective sense, but because the expectations were crushing or the family relationships were hollow. Money can't fix that. And in some cases, it seemed to make it worse by removing the need for families to actually function as a unit.
That tracks with the research on the unhappy minority. If your unhappiness is coming from family dysfunction or mental health issues, a bigger house doesn't address the root cause.
And I think this is where the public discourse about money and happiness often fails. It treats happiness as this single thing that money either does or doesn't buy. But happiness isn't one thing. It's a collection of experiences and evaluations that respond differently to different inputs. Money is great at reducing certain kinds of suffering, the suffering that comes from material deprivation, from insecurity, from lack of options. It's much less effective at creating positive well-being once those problems are solved. And it's almost completely useless against suffering that comes from broken relationships, meaninglessness, or mental illness.
If someone listening is trying to figure out how much to care about money versus other things in their own life, what's the practical takeaway from all this research?
I'd say there are a few things. First, if you're financially stressed, if you're not able to meet basic needs or you're constantly worried about money, getting to a place of financial stability should be a high priority. The happiness gains from moving from insecurity to security are real and significant. Second, once you're at that point, the returns to additional income diminish. Not to zero, but to a level where you should be thinking seriously about trade-offs. Taking a higher-paying job that makes you miserable is probably a bad happiness trade. Working 80 hours a week to afford a bigger house that you'll adapt to in 6 months is probably a bad trade. Third, spend your money on things that actually move the happiness needle. Time with friends and family. Experiences that create memories. Reducing commute time, there's good research showing that a long commute is one of the most reliable predictors of daily unhappiness, and people consistently underestimate how much it affects them. Giving money away also seems to increase happiness, though the effect is modest. Basically, use money to buy time, buy experiences, and buy freedom from things you hate doing.
The commute finding is interesting. I remember seeing a study that found you'd need something like a 40% raise to compensate for the happiness loss of an additional hour of commuting. Is that right?
That sounds about right. It was a paper by Alois Stutzer and Bruno Frey, two Swiss economists, and they found that the compensation required for a longer commute was surprisingly large. People don't fully account for adaptation when they make housing decisions. They think, I can handle the drive for a nicer house, and then 6 months later, the nicer house is just their house, but the drive is still miserable every single day.
Because you don't adapt to commuting the way you adapt to a house. It's unpredictably bad. Traffic varies, there's construction, there are aggressive drivers. It's a daily dose of low-grade stress that never becomes background noise.
And this gets at a broader principle that I think is underappreciated. The things that money can buy that produce lasting happiness tend to be things that either remove chronic sources of unhappiness or provide ongoing novelty and social connection. The things that don't work are things that you adapt to quickly and then take for granted, and most material purchases fall into the second category.
Let's talk about one more dimension that I haven't seen as much research on, the role of relative versus absolute income. You mentioned earlier that comparison effects are weaker for experiences than for goods. But how much of the money-happiness relationship is actually about keeping up with a reference group rather than absolute purchasing power?
This is a huge question in the literature, and there's a real debate about it. The relative income hypothesis says that what matters for happiness isn't how much you earn in absolute terms, but how much you earn compared to other people, your neighbors, your coworkers, your college classmates. And there's a lot of evidence for this. One famous study found that people would rather earn $50,000 in a world where everyone else earns $25,000 than earn $100,000 in a world where everyone else earns $200,000. The absolute amount is lower, but the relative position is higher. And that seems to matter more to reported happiness.
Which is completely irrational from an economic perspective, but makes perfect sense from an evolutionary one. Status is relative. You can't eat status, but your ancestors' reproductive success probably depended on it.
And there's some clever empirical work on this. Erzo Luttmer at Dartmouth found that people are less happy when their neighbors earn more, controlling for their own income. The effect is about as large as the effect of their own income. So, if your neighbor gets a raise and you don't, your happiness drops about as much as it would rise if you got the raise yourself. It's a zero-sum game at the neighborhood level.
Which is kind of a depressing implication. It suggests that economic growth might not increase aggregate happiness if everyone rises together, and what matters is relative position.
This is the Easterlin paradox again, just reformulated. And I should note that the relative income hypothesis is contested. Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfers, in that paper I mentioned earlier, argue that absolute income matters more than the relative income people claim. And there's a methodological issue. When you ask people hypothetical questions about trade-offs between absolute and relative income, they might answer differently than how they'd actually feel in those situations. But the weight of the evidence does suggest that relative comparisons matter a lot. It's just not the whole story.
Where does that leave us with the original question? Money does make people happier. The relationship is logarithmic. There's no single cutoff that applies to everyone, but the effect is modest compared to other factors in life. Is that the consensus?
I think that's the consensus among researchers who actually work on this. The popular media wants a clean number, $75,000, $100,000, whatever, but the science doesn't support a clean number. What it supports is a set of principles. Financial security is important. Beyond that, more money helps, but with diminishing returns. How you spend matters more than how much you have. And the biggest determinants of happiness are the things that don't show up on a pay stub.
I think there's something almost reassuring about that. If happiness were purely a function of income, most of us would be stuck. You can only increase your earnings so much. But if it's about relationships and purpose and how you structure your daily life, those are things you can work on regardless of your income level.
And it's worth noting that the research on happiness interventions, things people can actually do to become happier, shows that some pretty simple practices have measurable effects. Expressing gratitude, savoring positive experiences, performing acts of kindness, strengthening social connections. These aren't expensive. They don't require a raise. And the effect sizes are comparable to or larger than what you'd get from a substantial income increase.
Which isn't to say money doesn't matter. It clearly does, especially at the low end. But the cultural obsession with the money-happiness link might be distracting us from things that matter more.
I think that's the real takeaway. Money is a tool. It's a very useful tool for solving certain problems and creating certain opportunities. But it's not the goal, and treating it like the goal leads to bad decisions. Taking jobs you hate, neglecting relationships, chasing status goods that don't actually make you happier. The research is pretty clear on this, even if the headlines keep trying to simplify it into a single number.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Linear A script used by the Minoan civilization remains undeciphered, but its successor Linear B was cracked in the 1950s and turned out to encode an early form of Greek, meaning we can read the palace inventory records of Bronze Age Greece, but have no idea what the Minoans were writing about. To put that in modern terms, it would be like being able to read every shipping manifest from Eritrea in the 1980s while the entire literary output of a neighboring civilization remains completely opaque.
A lot of geography in one fact.
This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It actually helps. We'll be back soon with whatever Daniel sends us next.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.